Hi everyone, welcome to Potluck Food Talks. We're recording here in San Sebastian and suddenly the sun came out.
Like the golden child you are.
Let there be light.
Yeah.
And we're having like a super nice coffee from Simona. And I was just mentioning that was the old place where Sacona used to be, but this is still Sacona coffee, roasted by Sacona. And it's a super nice coffee. What can you say about it?
It's really nice. I love this sort of coffee. There's these kinds of coffee that are especially like suited for like flat whites that have, or like, you know, milky coffees that have this almost like blueberry flavor.
Berry, absolutely berry. Yeah. Like I feel berries all over the place on this one.
It's super nice, yeah. You know what I'm super curious about is the Noma coffee.
Oh yeah.
Product.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah.
We actually knew this since we went to Noma. They revealed this to us and made us promise not to say anything until they make the... the first press release, which was yesterday or the day before?
Yeah, I think the day before.
Yeah.
I mean, we had some coffee at Noma, but we had this like this coffee mix with like the like lacto-fermented rose, espuma.
And was that like a koji coffee, right? Like.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Super yeah. Nice.
I'd be really interested to see like what the difference in approach is for them, you know?
And we also have some breakfast.
Yeah.
This is Ama cheesecake. For me, the guys at Ama, they kind of coined this.
Wait. Hold on. What the fuck is going on here?
There was a mouse.
What the fuck is going on, guys?
Someone couldn't resist.
Unbelievable.
We met it yesterday, so there was some vandalism in the apartment.
Obviously.
No. So I actually talked with Javi, who is one of the head chefs. There are two executive chefs at Ama, two partners. And he told me they took the one of the many versions of Hilario Arbeláez, who was the chef at Suberoa, who first coined a style of cheesecake with blue cheese.
Mm.
And they took one of the many versions he had, and they developed it into their own thing. So the key feature about this cheesecake is it has blue cheese. Like you would notice, if I haven't told you, I already spoiled. I should have played the guess what it is game. And it's so little that you don't notice if nobody tells you, but enough that you will miss it if it's not there.
Yeah.
So give it a taste and let me know what you think.
Ooh,
it's too windy here.
It's very creamy. It's got a perfect texture.
Well, I should film this as well. The texture moment.
That's very good. If you look, it's set, but it's like ultra creamy. That's really fucking good.
This is my favorite cheesecake in the Basque Country.
I understand why. And the cheese flavor is so subtle. It's actually funny, like the best cheesecake that I've had before also here in the Basque Country, I mean like Basque style cheesecake, they had some goat's cheese in it, some fresh goat's cheese. It's very good. It's Cristina Lirola made it. It's super, super nice. Actually, a friend of mine who makes German-style cheesecake. I had his cheesecake one time, and he put some aged Gouda in it. Just a little bit, you know? And it's got the same effect. It just makes it, like, complex and fucking... Wow.
Well, I have to say, this is not my favorite cheesecake of them all, Basque cheesecake. My favorite cheesecake is, you know, my friend Jose, the Colombian guy.
Yes.
He started, like, a startup in Colombia. It's called La Vasca. And they're, for me, that's the very best cheesecake. He does like a cookie crust,
mm-hmm.
which is not so common in Basque style. The key feature is usually crustless style. But, I mean, who doesn't like a cookie?
Cookie crust is so classic. Combining like New York style with like Basque style in the best way.
So, and that one has also like an aged cheese. And I know he did like dozens of tests until he got the sweet spot. And for me, it's 10 out of 10, that one. This is also 10 out of 10, but I like that one better. You can find that in here in Spain, only in Bogota and Medellin.
Honestly, moment. I love the size also, you know? I've always, like, with Basque cheesecake, also when I was doing trials for restaurants, I always wanted a smaller cheesecake, but I could never get the cooking right. I was always dreaming of like an individual cheesecake portion or like to share for two people, but I could never get the cooking right because it was like either too much or too little, blah, it was like super awkward. This size is super nice.
This has become so popular, it's crazy, man. Like, I think 2 years ago in the New York Times, thanks to Marty Buckley's book. Marty Buckley, she's like a food journalist that lives here in San Sebastian, and she's been writing about pinchos and Basque food for decades.
Mm.
Her book, was it her book, Pinchos? I think it was that one, where the Basque cheesecake is featured. So it made it to the New York Times as iconic dessert of the year, I think about 2 years ago. It was already insanely popular at the moment, back then, but now it's insane. Like, I was in Japan and there were Basque cheesecakes all over the place.
They love that shit, yeah, yeah. It's like exploded, huh?
And interestingly enough, as you know, this thing is 20 years old, not older than that.
And that is the most interesting thing. I was telling this to like a friend of mine the other day. We were talking about like, and like people's perception from the outside, what is traditional and what's not, you know? And he was like, oh yeah, the Basque country, amazing. Cause I was telling him I was gonna come here. He was like, oh, so much like food tradition, like this and that, Basque cheesecake. And I was like, ah, but you know, it's like really interesting. And how quickly something goes from being something new to being so ingrained in the culture, because it makes so much sense. It fits. To the cooking culture.
Yeah, I think this is already a tradition, a very young tradition. 20 years is very, very young for a tradition, but I think it already has that level. So for example, you say Catalan food. There are some things that make Catalan different from the rest of Spain. First thing that comes to my mind is maybe pine nuts. You know, like they will add pine nuts to some dishes. And for me, if I see that, I know. Or Sicily, you know, you can feel Sicily is different from the rest of Italy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I would think about pine nuts and sardines again, you know, like, and lemon, and I don't know, and maybe some chilies, or I don't know. And in Basque food, there are like also these features that could be what we saw, codfish for sure, grilling, like the vegetables treatment, you know, like, and all of these things were there, but there were not. You had to have like some background knowledge of what Basque cuisine is to understand that's 100% Basque, you know, like, yes. Even though it's not non-obvious or non-traditional for the untrained eye. So
that's true. That's very true. Yeah. 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 But like, even like with the texture of the sauces, you know, it's just like you find it in like in, for example, Chinese cooking, you find this like gourmet approach to texture and this stickiness that we had yesterday in some of the pilpil sauces, and also taking the concept of a pilpil into like a non-traditional thing, you know, that's super, super genius and very modern and very like free, but for sure 100% Basque. Yeah, even like just the, I mean, this is a technique that comes originally from Ugaritz, where they're like, okay, how can we do the pilpil technique, which again, if this is the first time you're ever listening to us talk about pilpil, which is a sauce emulsified with fish gelatin, usually from bacalao or from cocochas with like very gelatinous fish. And what they did is they made a very neutral stock out of like salt cod skins that they then reduced to a certain brix, to a certain density that they can then use to make a pilpil out of basically anything, which is genius.
And we had pepper pilpil, we had like plain cod pilpil, that there were like different things.
Chive pilpil.
I think, so there were dishes that were good, very good, but they were, for me, three dishes that were mind-blowing. And that was for sure the tear peas.
The guisantes lágrima, yeah.
Guisantes lágrima,
tear-shaped peas.
Baby peas.
Which are like caviar, like in this season. It's a very short season.
They're now in season. We're going to try probably today as well and tomorrow as well. Let's see. But he said he takes them a little bit bigger, so they're better for charcoal grilling. And they were mixed with normal peas. The whole thing binded together with a cod pilpil. And yeah, as I said, this dish, I see pretty clearly the reference to Mugaritz.
100%.
To a dish. I don't know if the first version was made by Paco Morales, but when I was there, Paco Morales did a version that was named Dish of the Year. This was back in 2005. And it's in the Chlorophylla book as well. It's one of the classics of Mugaritz.
Actually, when I worked at Mugaritz, we had a dish that was like, it's almost like a lineage, you know? You have that dish that you're talking about. When I was there, we had a dish of guisantes lágrima that were raw. And then we juiced peas and we thickened it with inulina, which gives you this sort of like, almost like Nivea hand cream sort of texture. And so it was a very similar presentation. It was the peas bound together by this gel as like a little bowl with garlic flowers on top.
Garlic flowers on top. I saw the garlic flowers and I immediately identified the reference to Mugaritz.
Yes, 100%.
Because we haven't even mentioned that this restaurant belongs to the same restaurant group as Mugaritz and that the head chef was head chef at Mugaritz. So it stays everything under the same rooftop.
Yes.
That was one. The other one was the tuna belly, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
That was insane.
It was grilled, right? Very lightly grilled.
Grilled to perfection.
But like pink, almost raw in the middle.
Beautiful, with roasted peppers and a very strong sauce that all felt like meat.
The essence of the red peppers, basically. Again, kind of bound together by this like pil pil sauce.
A pil pil with roasted peppers, yeah. Like, we would do this pepper jus. I'm pretty sure they made it with that as a stock.
Yeah.
Which was, after you roast the peppers until they're charcoal black, they were put into a big bowl, as many as you could, and then covered with plastic foil, like three times.
Yeah.
It had to be three times, nor four, nor two. Otherwise, the recipe doesn't work. And then you would take the whole pepper and open it, and it would release this water that would be strained. And this is like a very subtle water that tastes like roasted peppers.
We used to do the same. We used to serve it with a little like braised veal cheek, which was like a play on like braised sort of like carilleras with like pimiento. And it was like so amazing. Just like thick, sweet umami juice with the meat. Super, super nice.
And then the abanico iberico.
Oh yeah, that was really good as well.
Yeah, that was, so we were trying to figure out what that cut was, and the actual name is abanico, and it's a part of the belly. On this side, this is from Joselito, and they only produce a certain amount a year, and they reserve it for very special clients, very special restaurants, and Muka got like this lot, so they could get just for a specific period a year, the supply for this piece of meat. For me, it felt like a very fatty flank steak. It felt similar to that. It felt braised, you know, like yes, in its own jus. Lots of wild mushrooms, lots of truffle. Nothing can go wrong with that.
Absolutely amazing. It was so good, but it was also cooked to perfection. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't have enough of that. I could go back and have like two more of the bellies, two more of the...
Easily. Yeah, desserts were also amazing. I mean, you already mentioned the honey with Jerez vinegar for the vanilla panna cotta. But also the peach ice cream with the...
Monastrell vinegar.
There's also
lots of vinegars around the different dishes.
Yeah, he mentioned he likes to play around with it. But it's so smart because like... And it's again, like the perfect simplicity is it's like you make an ice cream. It's very pure. It's very produce focused. And then you take another product, a very high quality product, and it just intrinsically makes sense. This acidity that cuts through the sweetness, but also this oxidative raisin flavor from the Monastero vinegar is absolutely great, perfect. You know, it's like a good vanilla or fior de latte ice cream with exceptionally good balsamic vinegar. You know, it just makes sense flavor wise.
Nothing can go wrong with that.
Yeah. Really, really outstanding dinner and one of the best dining experience I've had in the last couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah, I could agree with that, actually. Yeah. Also, for me, it's a very special moment, company. Also, it was my birthday. They sent me a birthday cake. Somebody told them it was my birthday.
You told them it was your birthday.
I did, okay. I was like, oh, what a surprise. Oh, How did you know?
Oh, thank you.
So what are the things, now that you're back here, that you have missed most about San Sebastian and the Basque Country?
Well, I mean, I miss the countryside for sure. It's just such a wild and pure environment. The mixture of mountain and ocean is just fucking amazing. You know, like people here take it for granted. Even if you like step outside of the airport in Bilbao, you know, and you take the bus to San Sebastian, it's just like forests after forests after forests. And, you know, cider factories and this and that, and rolling coastlines. And I mean, the city is beautiful. Like, it's not really a city, is it? It's more like a town.
Like a big town, small city, somewhere in between.
Yeah. But it feels, it's just the quality of life is just very
absolutely.
High. The food is great. The environment is good. If you don't mind the weather, I personally love the weather here. The fact that it like is kind of a little bit wild. Like it'll be like this and then suddenly it'll start storming and winding. It's just like raw, you know? Kind of reminds me, I always then have to think of like the Basque seafaring people just fucking, you know, going out into the world. It's just raw. And I love that about this place. Obviously, the food culture is, you know, super unique. And I mean, we spoke about it yesterday already a little bit. It's a food culture that has shaped the way that like I cook and what I find interesting and what I'm passionate about. It's shaped it massively, massively.
Same for me, yeah. Same for me. There are many things of also understanding the use of the produce and also how to express the produce on a dish. Not necessarily, for example, you don't need to roast almonds just to, that's not the only way to put almonds on a dish. You can put them fresh or you can put them white. And you said that, I would say if I had to use only one word to describe Basque cuisine, I would say subtleness. You know, the salt level is low. The flavors are, there are just very few elements. Also, the texture is very important. It's pretty much about texture more than flavor in many cases. And yeah, not so much about trying to enhance everything. It's just to letting it be, you know?
Yeah. And that takes a lot of balls and that takes a lot of skill that a lot of young chefs don't have. You know, it's often like, I mean, even like I sometimes fall into that trap where I'm kind of like, oh, I'm working on something. I'm like, oh, maybe this herb, maybe that, maybe that. And it's kind of like, well, maybe actually you should just revisit it and take some stuff away. But have the things that are there be really, really good and harmonious. Yeah.
If you had to choose one word for Basque cuisine, first thing that comes to your mind, just one.
Pure.
Okay, good one. Nice.
Yeah, and you?
I said subtleness.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could say the same about high-end Japanese cuisine.
Yes. Absolutely.
It's subtleness, and you can see that in the rice, for example. Rice appreciation is subtleness appreciation.
Oh, yeah, 100%. 100%. It is really valuing a product.
And the fine-tuning.
The fine-tuning is what in French cooking.
And that's something
cooking.
You don't get at the first time.
No, you need to
get into it and dive into the rice.
That's what the high-level French chefs call la geste. The gesture of how you do it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can cook rice a million fucking different ways, but there's this one thing is kind of like how you wash it, how you do this, how you adjust the fire, how you look at it, when you pull it off, how you fluff it.
Not too much, not too little of everything.
Just exactly that. And that's like the difference. And that's what in like general Spanish cooking I see a lot. It's like, you know, the example of making a tortilla. A tortilla is fucking potatoes, eggs, onions, yes or no, you know, whatever, olive oil, salt. That's it. Making a tortilla isn't the same as making a tortilla. It's not the same as making a tortilla. There are tortillas that are so extremely mediocre that you wouldn't think about them twice. And there's tortillas that are a culinary sensation. And it's the same ingredients. The only difference really is the gesture, the you know, the handling. Yeah.
And it's interesting. For example, here, one of the best tortillas in town is Bar Antonio's tortilla, right?
Yes.
And there's the original Bar Antonio that is in City Center and the Boulevard Bar Antonio.
Okay.
And both share the same recipe, same owner, same thing. But I think they're both slightly different.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't say better or worse. They're just different. And it's because of that, the gesture.
Of course.
Like the little details that get into the recipe of... But it's everything. There are so many variants. I remember Eckhard Witzigmann once saying that it's impossible to make like a food algorithm, and he said this many years ago. This man is like 90 years old today, because there are so infinite variables.
Yes.
Or for example, creating like a particular recipe, let's say for a jus or something that there are so many variables in terms of the produce, in terms of the equipment you're using, and everything determines how it will end. And that's where the chef intuition comes into play.
100%. I've always said this. It's like, you know, a lot of like inexperienced chefs that, for example, come to work with me, like they go a little bit nuts in the beginning because they're like, hey, can I have a recipe for this? And I'm like, not really. I can show you and I will show you. There's not really a recipe. And they're like, oh, how can there not be a recipe? And I'm like, well, you obviously don't get it, you know? Like there's things that you can have a recipe for, but there's some things that you, to make it how it should be, don't follow a recipe blindly, because it's never going to be that.
How would you define intuition? What's intuition for you?
It's a mixture of experience and lived passion for something.
That's very interesting, because I've thought about this a lot, and I've actually had discussions, deep discussions with Sander about the topic. For example, I'm talking right now, right? I'm formulating sentences that make somehow sense. So that's already intuition into play. Yes. You know, like, I'm not thinking about what I'm going to say. I'm just saying things, right? Yeah. Like, and there's like a, but yet again, there's like a whole intellect behind it that is feeding that intuition and allows me to formulate. And in cooking, I guess it's the same thing. You know, you have to accumulate intellect, understand things, like theories about techniques, and have like a whole book of recipes in your head, and understand how different processes work and all of these, in order to for you to culinarily speak, you know, like just flow.
Yeah. And absolutely.
Freestyle.
Absolutely. Yeah. But at the same time, you have to, you know, when we say that cooking is emotional, you know, we don't mean like, oh, I cooked this, it reminds you of your grandma, like blah, blah, blah. Of course, that can also be a part. But like, what I feel like it is that when you're making something, as what I just said, it's like there's a huge difference. You can make, two people can make the same thing. One person just does it. The other person really puts themselves into it. And there's no limit to how much love and care and attention you can give to something, of looking at all the fine details of, you know, just trying to coax out, you know, this like golden center of things, you know, of everything, of all these variables, you know. It's like juggling fucking 5 watermelons and 3 knives, you know, in a way. And sometimes you catch them all, sometimes you don't. But when you do catch them all, and when you, everything, all the planets align, then you have something sensational. And I think that's this like passionate, you know, living something, really living it, really feeling it out, paired with the intellect. Like, for me, that's what intuition and cooking is. Yeah.
I saw this interview with Alchemist. He traveled to Argentina. The interview was not with him, was with a record store owner. He was DJing for Eminem when he went to Argentina on his tour. And the man went into the record store and he said, "Give me all the local music you have." And the man was there like for 12 hours, just took next record, pam, pam, pam. And he bought some records and he sampled some Argentinian rock bands that were there, just there. And no Argentinian hip hop producer had ever touched. And he said something like, "My job is to recognize magic when I have it in front of me." And that for me speaks very much about an experienced chef when he recognizes this fine-tuning of this specific flavor, texture, or even storytelling, or whatever that makes a dish extraordinary, like recognizing this, while other could just oversee it and just continue their way.
Yeah.
That's what makes something magic.
Absolutely.
That's it for this week's episode of Potluck Food Talks. If you like what we're doing, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also find us on Instagram and TikTok as Potluck Food Talks. The show airs every Monday.